Hey folks, welcome to 2021. It's been fucking great so far.
Happy New Year.
Whee.
It's a time of optimism and positivity.
Yep.
It's all going very well.
Yeah, it's great. I'm loving it. Chris has become the new QAnon shaman, so it's going well.
Q's like a non-shaman.
But we are here doing this cursed episode of this band that is definitely cursed for us.
Even just Las today, Vegas. Somebody stole David's notes.
Yeah, I've been, my data has been breached.
The memory cards aren't working. I mean, it's just, there's definitely something.
My microphone stand broke, so I'm currently using a multitude of elastic bands.
The worst part is, you know that Robin Guthrie and Liz Fraser are champing at the bit to find out what we think of their career.
Well, exactly, and I know.
We just kept them hanging on like this. I'm sorry, guys, but we're gonna try and do it now, and I'm sure it'll all have been worth it for you.
Yep. So we're doing Heaven on Las Vegas by the Cocteau Twins for this. It feels like it's the second time, but it feels like the fourth time we've discussed it so much. And yeah. This is going to feel a bit weird doing this, because there was a lot of funny things in the original recording which we can't replicate here.
So it's Dave's choice as well. Mm-hmm. So here's some groundwork. Yesterday was my first day not hungover after the Christmas special.
Yeah, I feel like we've probably got to do some apologising out there.
Yes, we really do.
Or
we
you
really,
do, Chris, really anyway.
What are you looking at me for? I represented good value. I put my body on the line for the podcast.
You did.
I'm banned from a local chippy, I'm pretty sure, for getting into a fracas on the way home. I've got vague glimpses of memory of some guy refusing to mask up as I was getting my chips and cheese. The chippy's about 100 metres from my house, and I know that the chips didn't make it back to my house. So I don't know where they ended up. I'm pretty sure I whited at some point as well. But yeah, my flatmate, the infamous Luigi, woke me up the next morning because he'd found a bagel in the toilet and all my clothes scattered around the front room in the kitchen. Like, I'd just exploded out of them. I have very little memory of it. And one of the most amazing things is that I've never got to like blackout drunk level in our podcast before. I've been steaming in past Christmas specials, but never like that. I don't remember the last hour. From the Taylor Swift rant onwards, there's a period where I go really quiet that I know it's people have commented on. And I don't remember that period. But then when you're editing your own voice, like, imagine going on a total bender, but then having a high fidelity record of everything you got up to on that total bender.
Like, and then you have to go and pick through it.
Yeah. and listening through it was so bizarre because it was me, but I was like, wow, that's me. I don't remember any of this. And I identified some weird phenomena, such as after that period where I go quiet and I can't remember anything, I come back in and I'm actually quite lucid again. There's a period of like 15 minutes where my voice, I'm not slurring as much, I'm just more coherent. And I think like my brain must have had like limited bandwidth at that point, and it had reallocated it to try and make me coherent, and it had just completely given up on trying to write anything to the memory. So like, I think your brain starts to prioritize, like, we need to keep this guy safe and in one piece, so take all of the energy you're expending on trying to write this to memory and just transfer it into not walking in front of a bus, please. And yeah, so I didn't remember a lot of that. I didn't remember that we'd got to the end of the podcast. You guys told me we'd got to the end of the podcast, and then it turned out that Mark hadn't recorded the end of the podcast
somehow.
And then that's why it's got that amazing sort of a caretaker-esque ending on episode 4, because we didn't tape the final answers to some good questions as well. Mm. White dreadlocks and Vicky actually sent in a thing on that. The best people with dreadlocks, which were all white, obviously, because it's funnier.
Did we actually answer that?
Yeah, we answered everything, apparently.
Yeah,
I don't remember that.
I remember wrapping it up with you, Dave, because Chris was not in the room. I think he was in the toilet or something. And I was just like, you said, have a great Christmas. And I remember saying, you can't say that because by the time this goes out, it'll be the new year. And then you're like, we're doing Heaven to Las Vegas next. And then that was it.
Oh, God, yeah. I do remember that.
Oh, wow. And I didn't even know we drank sherry until I was editing part four. And you hear a bit where David hands me a bottle. I'm like, what's this? It's like sherry. And I go, that's for cooking. That's drinking. Yeah, so it was an interesting experience editing that, I will say. The last three questions that we didn't answer, I think we agreed that we'll do them for a town hall for subscribers. So we have a town hall that we're going to bring out shortly, and we'll do another one that includes those three questions, the one about Phil Spector as well. And yeah, and I can only apologise. There was, I'm not going to lie, there was a fair bit of stuff cut out of that last episode that there is no way the public is getting to hear. Just no way.
Yeah, I think that's probably
whatsoever.
For the best.
Also, if you ever have to edit your voice drunk, if you speed it up by 105%, you sound less drunk. There you go. That's something I found out. Yeah, so I mean, even Dave recorded like a safety recording for that because we were worried that something might go wrong. So Dave made a safety recording and then his entire fucking Mac crashed.
Yeah, I lost That's a week's worth of life, including that like, night.
You have no idea how cursed we've been for the last few while. But yeah, I mean, it could be worse. We could be living through what's basically Resident Evil now.
Yeah.
The shit films, not the good game. Or we could be American.
Yeah.
That'd be bad.
That would be bad, yeah. Sorry, Americans.
Yeah. I feel like even though this is a music podcast, we've talked about this stuff a lot, and it would be remiss not to at least comment on the entirely predictable outcome of 5 years of race baiting and divisive rhetoric. I can't remember the episode, but I have been proudly gloating for the last week that I called it play by play sometime around last March, I think, where I said that Biden was going to win, Trump was going to refuse to acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. It was going to like culminate in like civil unrest for the Trump supporters in DC. I just wish I was a gambling man.
Damn, Chris. Damn.
Well, you should do what I did. I can't remember if I discussed this with you, but I put on my only ever bet the night of the presidential election. I signed up to Betfair or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I put a bet on Trump winning. I think I put £20 on because they were offering pretty good odds. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah. Do you know what might actually happen? And then, like 4 hours in, I was able to cash out. And I got £42 back, I think. And then he lost. So I was able to win money on him winning the election, and also he didn't win the election. And then I just closed my account and I'll never gamble again.
Yeah.
See,
I am.
I think it was last May, I'd asked my dad to put money on for me, because I don't gamble, but my dad's all about it. And I was like, Dad, you know, next time you're in there, see if you can get some odds on Trump getting impeached for a second time. So he didn't, as far as I'm aware, he didn't actually put that bet on, but I think I could come through as well.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm a betting man, and I was watching the particular outcome of the election with that, and Trump's odds did at one point go all the way down to being the favourite. So yeah. That's probably when you cashed out, because then after that, I think it was after Pennsylvania was called, like his odds just were like totally fucked. It's like
cashed.
Yeah. So yeah.
It was really interesting. You know, I regarded as much as it was awful to see, and certainly when you found out that people had died, I still had the ubiquitous kind of images of that QAnon shaman and the podium thief and all those different characters. You're like, it's just one big fucking giant dopey LARP, isn't it? It's just like all these clowns. But then I think today when, you know, you found out they discovered like a makeshift gallows outside it, and then the FBI kind of revealed that they'd been tracking all these organised conversations on different channels about smuggling weapons in. They found a box of Molotov cocktails, they found the pipe bombs. It's kind of given us a different perspective on it, I think, and you realise just why people are so fucking outraged.
But correct me if I'm wrong, one of the deaths was from a Trump supporter who reached up to steal a painting and the taser went off, tased his testicles, and he died of a heart attack.
Three multiple times he tased his own genitals and so, apparently died,
you know,
of a heart attack.
There you go.
Apparently, he was very excited to be there.
That happened.
Yeah, that is a you know, first week of January, and the Darwin Awards already decided.
Yeah,
that's amazing. But yes, yeah, it's been an interesting few weeks on a number of fronts, and yeah, and we decided, you know what, fuck it, it was pretty soul destroying when we lost this episode the first time around, because it was really fucking good. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes when you're recording an episode, it just clicks, and as the guy that edits it, I kind of have developed an ear for when I'm not going to have a lot of work to do, and man, it really flowed. So it was a double blow, I think. But let's do it. I'm pretty sure it's going to be two parts, but we'll try not to labour it. Unfortunately, the first time round, we didn't actually know what each of us thought, other than David, obviously, and that was kind of a big part of it.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be able to feign. We're not even going to insult your intelligence by trying to feign surprise. Mark is not a fan, and I'm ambivalent, and I've got feelings, positives and negatives, that we'll go into. So I'm sorry you didn't get to appreciate it from that perspective, because it really worked really well. And I'm sorry Robin and Liz, I know you were choking to get that big reveal, that big heel turn at the end that Mark dropped, but that's just how it is. But Mark, I guess before we get into it, you're going to do a couple of shout outs, because I believe we have reached a very important landmark.
We have. So back in September, we said if we get 10 new subscribers, then we will do an ABBA mixtape, and we have reached 10 new subscribers since then. So the most recent three are Connor Prickett, thank you, Roy Young, and Roy Oi. Two Roys.
Strange. Roy Oi.
Roy Oi.
Roy Oi.
Roy Oi. Yeah.
Roy Oi.
Roy Oi.
Roy Oi.
Danny Dyer. Wow, okay, so it's ABBA mixtape time. And curiously enough, I think I sent you guys an outraged ABBA comment about a week ago, because I caught a documentary that was a sort of behind the music of their three biggest hits, and it cut off before the Super Trooper album, like it didn't fucking happen. I was like, absolutely ready to throw my fucking telly out the window. It's an outrageous thing to do. An outrageous thing to do. I mean, I couldn't fucking believe it. So that's going to come back up in that ABBA mix.
So the way that's working is that we're going to end up with like a 10 song best of.
Yeah, and then we're going to talk about all the ABBA albums and why they're so awesome.
Mm-hmm. And just generally fight at it.
Yeah.
It'll be a kind of friendly fight, though. It'll be a kind of homoerotic, flirty wrestle.
Yeah.
More than an actual.
Yeah, you can't be angry involving ABBA.
Oh, but they can.
Well, yeah.
Famously.
Right, so talking about genre defining pop music.
Why don't we good segue. He's professional.
The Cocteau Twins.
Cocteau Twins.
I think, given Dave's notes catastrophe, we're going to follow the pattern that we did the first time. So I'm going to kind of lead the history of this, because I did a little bit of deep dive. And then Dave, who is the avowed fan, is going to kind of take us through the albums. So bear with us if I have to give him a few cues. It's only because some rascal out there is running about with his notes. So, I mean, Cocteau Twins, just straight off the bat, we should probably say, like, they're a band I have been clearly very aware of without actually knowing them very well for most of my musical life. Like, they're especially coming from Scotland, like being part of the Scottish music scene, they've had a huge influence on bands here, let alone bands across the world. They're kind of credited with being the pioneers of both the dream pop genre and the shoegaze genre. One of those I agree with, one of them I kind of disagree with. We'll get to that. And whilst going through all their back catalogue, I did find stuff that I knew. I have to admit, I really had not probably immersed myself in Cocteau Twins the way you would expect a Scottish musician and booker to do. So I don't quite know why that is. Although now, having listened to it a lot, I don't know why that is. but Mark, what about you, man?
I'm in the same camp as you. Like, I was aware of their influence. You can't not be aware of the name and of the legacy they've kind of had on music, I suppose. So I had heard of them, was aware of them, knew they were quite big, quite influential, but hadn't listened to them. And I don't know why that is, because I do kind of like some shoegazy stuff, just not this kind.
Dave.
And I guess I should just like pause on the, like, I'm not a Cocteau Twins fanboy by any means, and I think going into this, like, I knew a couple of records and I knew like their biggest tracks, and I definitely knew Heaven or Las Vegas, the album that we're doing, but you know, I was going through a few of these albums as blind as you two were as well, because yeah, I just hadn't deep dived. I think I mentioned, like, before, there was some point, I think it was, I probably should have been studying for uni, and I was at home, and I just decided to, like, all right, fuck it, I'm going to fill in all my old gaps in, you know, legendary albums and stuff like that. And so there was My Bloody Valentine, Cocteau Twins, Jesus and Mary Chain. Were three big ones that were kind of seen as like a holy trinity, untouchable of that late 80s indie scene. And Heaven or Las Vegas was the album that stuck with me from going back and finding and going through those bands. But yeah, it's been interesting going through and, you know, seeing the context of that album. And
You mentioned obviously My Bloody Valentine and Jesus and Mary Chain. Jesus and Mary Chain, also a Scottish band who are credited with being the pioneers, I think, shoegazed. I think that's probably a bit fairer than Cocteau Twins. Mm-hmm. But I think we've identified the phenomenon on this podcast many times that there are some persons and some acts that fall into like a category of the unimpeachables. You know, we've spoken of PG Harvey, we've spoken about Tom Waits, Nick Cave, I think probably Radiohead, even though people bitch about them.
Tom York. Yeah.
So there's a host of acts. They're sort of like the kind of, they're the acts that tend to get a stamp of approval in like what would be like Q magazine and stuff as well. You know, they're like highbrow, like Björk, obviously, yeah. And you know, it's very rare that you'll hear somebody really go to town on them for something. And I kind of find that Cocteau Twins are in that category as well. It's very, you know, they seem to be sort of universally praised in most circles, not Mark's house, but most circles. And my reaction, and it's because I'm a total contrarian, is that sometimes really puts me off an act. Agreed. Where they just seem to have like an unequivocal seal of approval whenever they bring something out without actually judging the release on merit. And I think going back through Cocteau Twins from the perspective of somebody that doesn't have any dog in the fight, I'm not nearly as blown away by them as most people seem to be. And I think they're very... They are the beneficiaries of that Emperor's New Clothes phenomenon a lot of the time, where they've sort of been picked for a variety of reasons, right place, right time, you know, right vibe, and certainly enough moments of excellence that managed to kind of give them some credibility. But then from there seems to have been a bit of a mythology built up around them that I don't know, when you listen to their back catalogue, if it's entirely merited across the piece. This album seems to be unanimously the one that is the standout, although Treasure, I think, gets a lot of praise as well. There are some other moments that are really downright fucking cringeworthy, and... yeah, we'll break that down a little bit. To give a little bit of background to them, one thing that's really interesting is that they come from Grangemouth, which is kind of near where I grew up, outside between Falkirk and Stirling. It's like an industrial town, and Grangemouth's a really weird place. It's a huge oil refinery. It's a very working class area. There was like an old school village, like a typical Scottish village with like, you know, a church and little pubs and that kind of like little bungalows and all this kind of stuff. And then on the edge of it is this behemoth of like industrial smoke and refineries and giant silos and flames that rocket up into the sky at night. And I mean, it's crazy. When I was a kid, we used to like roll bangers and go out there and just sit and look at this kind of dystopian landscape of Grangemouth. Or like when they're burning off the gases from the refinery at night, it lights up the sky for like 50 miles around with these huge flames. It's really bizarre. And that actual area of Scotland was used to be like the cancer capital of Europe. It was the cancer belt. It was like something like 33%, a third more likely to get cancer in that part of Scotland, partly due to the contamination, the pollution that came from all the industrial units that were across there, and like the river that ran through it as well. We spoke about an area just in the edges of Grangemouth called Skinflats, which is one of the most godforsaken places you'll ever set eyes on, quite apart from the fact that it's called Skinflats, which is disgusting. It is this weird, parched, muddy, grassy, I don't even know what to call it. It's not a bog. It's just this horrible, empty, kind of gaping abyss of despair that lies just off this refinery and sort of deals.
Sorry to any Skinflats listeners.
No, I mean, I was already sorry to them. I mean, that is a really depressing place to drive through. It's a really odd place. And so when I think about Grangemouth, it's a bit like, you know, there is an element of that environment must inform the music a wee bit. I mean, Arab Strap come from that kind of area as well. So does Adam Stafford. You can't escape that weird feeling around Falkirk and Grangemouth in particular. It's just, it's a strange part of Scotland, and there is something vaguely almost Soviet about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Those towns and cities in the north of Russia that are like big industrial cities, and they're like just stretches of water that are just filthy and stuff. There's something really odd about that place. And I think, you know, it must play a part in the kind of ghostliness and the pessimism that a lot of these acts have in their music. Because it certainly instills that in me. Yeah. Have you guys ever been?
Actually, I was going to say, I drove my flatmate back to Fife on Christmas Eve. And actually, the sat-nav took us down past Grangemouth or past Falkirk toward as we were getting there. And yeah, even seeing it, just all that up and still like in full operation in the middle of a lockdown on fucking on Christmas Eve was just a totally strange thing. It does look like, it's hard to put into words exactly what it feels like and looks like being anywhere near it. You know, you can look at pictures of it, but until you see the actual scale of it in person, it's almost like a city in and of itself.
Yeah, it really is. And when you think about the fact that the village that is really quite small, that this giant, it's like a tumour that is like 100 times bigger than the body. It's really fucking strange. Apparently, I think it's like third or fourth as well in the list of places that would be hit with nuclear weapons in the event that the UK was attacked.
Yeah, and I always heard that if there was like an explosion there, that it would be, there would be a radius of like 30 miles. Because of the amount of fuel stored there, and you know, explosive, yep, and stuff like that.
See, when I think we might have mentioned this in the show before, but I want to put it back in again because it's an amazing fact. Have you ever been to the Falkirk Stadium following your glorious Staggies, Dave?
I have been, yeah. No, yeah, it wasn't so actually for a county game, but I can't remember why I was there. But I've been to Falkirk Stadium. Yeah.
Well, Falkirk Stadium has, I think it's 2.5 almost. Big stands that they built, new stands, mm-hmm, and they weren't allowed to rebuild the opposite side, which is like this old dog shit stably fucking bit of junk.
Yeah.
And the received wisdom is that the reason that was refused is because that stand fell within the blast radius of Grangemouth, and putting a big stand there would have been basically sitting 6,000 people, whatever, inside the blast radius. So as to whether or not that is actually the reason, I don't know. But if you cut around Stirling and Falkirk, that's what people say, that the reason that stand was refused was because of the Grangemouth blast radius. Imagine that, you're playing the game, and as long as you're not playing in the left wing, you don't get burned up in a hellfire. Centre mid's like, whoa, Jesus, that looks sore. So 1979, the band came together really in Grangemouth, this area. It was originally Robin Guthrie and a guy called Will Heggie were performing as a project known as The Heat. I mean, they performed around that area. They used to also DJ, and I think one night Robin was DJing at a place called Hotel International, which is a hilarious name for a hotel in Falkirk. Hotel International, which may or may not still be there, they were playing a lot of stuff that wasn't really going down well with the crowd, like Birthday Party and the pop group, really oddball sort of post-punk and things like that. But there was one girl in the middle of the floor dancing to all of it, and it was a girl called Liz Fraser. This girl who had like, you know, Susie Sue tattoos and seemed to be really into this out there music. She was really, really shy, but they approached her, and Robin's described in interviews just thinking that he just knew that this girl was going to be able to sing, and so they said, look, why don't you team up with us? And this became Cocteau Twins. They got the name from a Simple Minds B-side, I think it is. It's like a Simple Minds rarity. Yeah, and the story of Cocteau Twins in the early years is just like the Willy Wonka golden ticket. It's fucking ridiculous, and even Robin Guthrie reflects back in it, you know, wryly observing how ridiculous it is. They had got talking to Phil Colbert, the drummer of the Birthday Party. They were big fans of the Birthday Party, obviously Nick Cave's band, and he'd encouraged them at the time to send a demo to 4AD and John Peel. So the band had recorded two cassettes. They couldn't actually copy the cassettes, so they just performed twice and recorded using this wee Grundig mono cassette recorder in Robin Guthrie's mum's front room, I think it was. So they had two cassettes of these performances, probably sounded like shit, but they decided they were going to go down to London, and while they were going to see the Birthday Party play a concert there, they were going to go to BBC Radio, drop off one for Peel and give the other to a guy called Ivor Watts Russell, who was the founder of 4AD Records. He listened to it and he liked it, but the quality of the recording was pretty poor. I can't remember the chronology, but basically I think he got them down pretty soon after to do an EP, and as soon as he heard Liz Fraser singing, he was like, wow, this didn't come across in the tape, this is incredible, we need to do an album instead of just an EP. And so that's what they did. They went on to do this full record. They also, within about 3 months, as well as recording that debut album, 3 months, it's mental, had also performed a Peel session. So it's a pretty astonishing rise. By the way, I love the fact that a return ticket to London for them cost £4. Amazing.
Jeez.
So that first album is Garlands. Initially, they were kind of criticised by like NME in particular, who said they were ripping off Susie and the Banshees. And this sort of very early on led to quite an awkward, standoffish relationship with the press. Robin Guthrie is definitely not the most amiable of guys. He's very frank in his interviews, to the point of being rude sometimes. It just seems to be part of his thing. But, you know, they don't suffer fools gladly, and I guess in music that's understandable. His experience of recording that album down in London as well, it wasn't great. Cocteau Twins used to put their drum machine at that time through a lot of distortion and play it out of amps. They were kind of quite pioneering in that sense, and Guthrie found that the engineers down there, whilst they were perfectly nice people, they weren't really willing to let the band do these things. They were sort of going too much by the book, and he felt it really stifled it. So when you go back and listen to Garlands, it's a lot politer and a lot cleaner than the band actually sounded at that time. So, I mean, listen to that, it's harder to see why they were getting grouped in with, for example, with Chugies, which was quite crunchy and quite noisy and saturated, when this album's just a little bit meek. And he kind of vowed that going forward he was going to play a much bigger role in the production of the records, so that these records were sort of truer to what the band itself was. Dave, you got any thoughts on that first album, man?
Yeah, I mean, I think you were the one that... You hadn't heard Susie and the Banshees. You missed them until going through this.
It, It was doing the research for this album that I listened to Susie and the Banshees and got seriously into some of their, like, there's the third and fourth album in particular. I thought they were fucking brilliant.
And you can definitely see the influence. I guess quite a lot of that is down to the production. They wanted to, you know, be bigger, have that larger guitar sound, and it was just kind of held back. There's some good tunes on there. It definitely has like a sort of Killing Joke sort of vibe as well. But like Wax and Wayne, really like that tune.
Yeah, it's kind of got the most minor progression on it, so it's got a kind of more gothy vibe.
Yeah.
Which I think kind of works better for them. I quite liked Blind, Dumb and Deaf.
Yeah.
Which has that sort of like early Cure feel to it. It's quite atonal. It's interesting as well that in like 81, 82, I think that was when Robert Smith was playing guitar for Susie and the Banshees. I mean, Susie and the Banshees started off, as I now know, as a much more overtly punk thing, but quite quickly transitioned into a post-punk thing. Even by like their second and third album, they really don't sound a lot like, you know, you wouldn't group them with Sex Pistols or Clash at all. They're much more aligned with like Wire and some of the early Cure stuff. And, you know, that weird circular influence thing, Robert Smith being in Susie and the Banshees at the time, but Cocteau Twins ended up being a big influence on Robert Smith. He's a huge fan of them. I think the album Treasure, he played it at his wedding, or he played the album as he was getting ready for his wedding.
Yeah.
Guthrie, even though he wasn't able to execute the drums the way he wanted, he was really, really innovative as a guitarist. He openly admits he's not particularly technically skilled guitarist, and when you watch Cocteau Twins play, it's amazing sometimes how little he's actually doing. I don't mean that as a criticism, I just mean some of the lines are really driven by the amount of effects and processing that are on them. It's not him playing these incredibly dense chord shapes or patterns. He was really using a lot of like clever processing. I think probably in terms of innovation, probably second only to The Bagpipe Pedal by Stuart Adamson. Absolute classic tone.
Classic. At the Edge, of course. He was really moving things forward in the late 80s, early 80s.
Proper legends. But yeah, Guthrie like really innovated with the guitars. And I think that's probably the strongest connection to shoegaze, really. When they get associated with shoegaze, there's not really a lot that I see, especially as you go further on through the records, but his guitar work, the saturation, the size, the expanse of it, the processing, that has a lot in common with shoegaze. It's interesting though, I think there was like a little bit of animosity between them and My Bloody Valentine, because the shoegaze movement, you're talking about bands like Slow Dive, Swerve Driver, Jesus and Mary Chain, who we spoke of, the early Ride stuff, but My Bloody Valentine are like probably the most obvious reference point for that movement. But they were so pissed off at the comparisons and at the use of certain sounds by, for example, Robin Guthrie. So whatever Cocteau Twins used, My Bloody Valentine deliberately didn't use. they would use something else just to try and like avoid that connection, which I think that's pretty interesting. And on the other side of it, as I said, they've been really credited with the dream pop movement, which I think is a very, very fair comparison. The early stuff of bands like Lush, Mazzy Star, definitely more recent stuff like Beach House, which is maybe a slightly more emo version of Cocteau Twins.
Yeah,
and you know, through both of those branches, I think they've the reach has been kind of exponential. You know, Smashing Pumpkins are big fans of them. Deftones, Chino Moreno especially, is a big fan of them. So are Warpaint, and so's Grimes. You know, they really do have a sort of much broader appeal through the first and second generations of bands they influenced. Really early on, they toured with Birthday Party. Obviously, there's a Birthday Party connection pretty much through most of the early stuff. And then they got an opening slot with OMD, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, in 1983. And that was a European tour, and it was a really, really big moment for them. Yeah, I mean, you look at that early trajectory, you know, Dream Ticket, as I said, the like first demo, two copies, you get a record deal, an appeal session. As I say, Robin Guthrie admits that, like, back then, they assumed that this was how it worked. They had so much self-belief. They're really young, you know, and I guess if you're in a band, you often feel like that, like, you know, we've got something special. But because lightning had struck, they assumed this is how it worked. They actually thought 4AD are lucky to be the label that get us. They didn't feel lucky getting the deal. They thought 4AD's lucky that they're the ones we've gone for. Which I think's, it's funny. It's especially funny now that he realises how absurd that was. But after that OMD tour, which was a huge moment for them, Will Heggie left the band. I think he found it just too taxing, too draining, wasn't really cut out for that kind of like full-time thing. And around about that time, Robin Guthrie and Liz Fraser actually started dating, which would later result in marriage, a child, and divorce. 83, they brought out Head Over Heels.
Yeah,
so that's the EP. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is where they really start to get into the dream pop thing. I think it's got the track Sugar Hiccup on it, which is a really identifiable tune by the group.
We should also mention that like, we're going to talk about the albums, but throughout this, they're also a very big EP band, and they fill in a lot of the gaps, like sonically and thematically, between album releases.
Absolutely, and actually, what we'll get to is the fact that I actually think the collections of EPs are as good as, if not better, than most of the albums. They're really interesting. 83, though, September 83, a track was released called Song to the Siren, which is a cover of Tim Buckley. Now my foolish boat is leaning, broken off long on your own. Now, this was done under the moniker This Mortal Coil, and This Mortal Coil was actually a bit of a supergroup. It's a bit like the Reindeer Section tried to be in Scotland, you know, the turn of the century, just after. And this track, it was actually Guthrie and Fraser, so it was effectively Cocteau Twins. It charted really well. I mean, it's a beautiful version of the song, although the original was beautiful as well. Now my foolish boat is leaning, broken love long on your rocks. But I know that Fraser in particular was really frustrated that they'd finally charted with something that wasn't actually under their name. There's other This Mortal Coil stuff out there. I'm kind of indifferent to it, but that is a really nice version of that song. In 84, a guy called Simon Raymond joined the group. Simon would go on to be a really important part of that, especially later in their career, given the relationship and then the dissolution of the relationship between Guthrie and Fraser. Simon sort of was the glue that kept the band together. They brought out an EP called Spangle Maker.
Yeah, The Spangle Maker.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, in 84, and it's got Pearly Dewdrops Drops, which became, I think, their first really overt attempt at a pop single, and a lot of people was one of their favourite tracks by them. Mm-hmm. Kind of key to that as well was that Guthrie was at the helm of the engineering on it. He was really getting to kind of stamp what he saw as their sound. There was a remix of it came out by Watts Russell, the guy that started 4AD that Guthrie hates, although I think a lot of people acknowledge that it was probably better. It was their first record to chart as well, top 40. At this time they did a few kind of idiosyncratic things. They refused the magazine Smash Hits the permission to start printing their lyrics, and this kind of became a theme for a lot of their records right up until about 93. Liz Fraser often doesn't seem to actually be singing words, and we'll break that down a bit as we talk about the albums, but yeah, there's definitely a point where she just goes to town on the notion of deconstructing sort of the English language for the purposes of lyrics. They also refused a show on Top of the Pops. Now, for anyone that's not for the UK, I mean, that's a huge decision, because if you go on Top of the Pops, you're a chart band, you are recognised in households, especially in the early 80s. Everybody was watching Top of the Pops. It was the place to be. The problem with Top of the Pops was that for much of its history, it was mimed. Sometimes entirely, other times the backing band was mimed and the singers sang live. Sorry if you're from the UK and you're very familiar with this, but I'm just bearing in mind we've got a lot of listeners that aren't. This led to like people sometimes taking the piss out of that a wee bit. Nirvana went on, did Smells Like Teen Spirit, and Cobain sang it all like an octave down in a sort of Morrissey baritone. You had people doing things like that. But
which band was it that they all swapped instruments?
Muse.
I don't know.
That was Muse.
Was that Muse?
Yeah. I know that Blur went on and played, like, they took tiny baby instruments on and played one of their tracks like that, and the Eels did something similar.
Yeah. But the thing was, Top of the Pops was this weird thing where it was so mainstream, but it was still somehow legitimate, because it was like, if you were in the charts, then you got to go on, and it didn't matter what genre you were. I don't know, it seems like a kind of weird, naive era of, oh, we're just going to put on, you know, anything. And I guess it was kind of before there were real proper pluggers and stuff like that. And it had just been like...
Definitely.
So although it was mainstream, it was still kind of legitimate in a sort of...
Yeah, there was opportunity, because you can go back... I mean, okay, Cocteau Twins refused to go on it because they thought it would be like balloons and dancing girls, and they couldn't imagine the idea themselves miming on it. But if you go back and look at old Top of the Pop shows, you'll see like bands that were like right out there. Yeah. You know, there's been some really far out performers on it. So especially then, as you say, I mean, as it got into the 90s, it became a lot more, tedious. But yeah, there was, in those naive young days, apart from the amount of child abusers hosting it, they also had a lot of pretty kick-ass and unexpected bands appearing on it.
Maiden did play live on it. Like, I think one of the only bands to play live, and it was Iron Maiden.
There was an era as well in the 90s where Top of the Pops tried to go fully live, because there were a bunch of shows coming out with like the White Room and things like that, and so they tried to compete by going fully live, but it was just hard to control. And then obviously the fact that as music became more processed, they had fewer and fewer bands that could go on and play live, because so few bands nowadays actually do play live, let's be honest, and especially in the charts it's all backing tracks. So it became sort of like the reality of music converged on the old reality of Top of the Pops, if you know what I mean. As Top of the Pops tried to go a bit more real, music got a bit less real. So but yeah, that was a big decision for them, big decision for a band, you know. That probably could have propelled them into a much, much more mainstream reputation, the kind of thing that, you know, your ma has heard of, that kind of thing. Top of the Pops had that level of influence, so credit to them for sticking by that. 84, they brought out Treasure. Now, they actually approached Brian Eno about recording this album. I think they went for like coffee with him, and supposedly Robin Guthrie was in a really foul mood at the meeting, was really quite disagreeable, and ultimately Brian Eno said, look, I don't need to be involved in this project because you don't need me. Like, Robin Guthrie had so many of his own ideas and so much of his own vision that Brian Eno was just trying to encourage them, like, just do it yourselves, like, you've got the right ideas, you've got such you get so much motivation to make it sound the way it is in your head, to just insist on it. They ended up recording at Palladium Studios in Edinburgh. We've mentioned this before. It's not there anymore, Palladium, but just on the outskirts of the city. It's really snowbound at the time, which I think actually kind of contributes brilliantly to the whole kind of atmosphere of Cocteau Twins. The thought of them recording, being barricaded inside by layers and layers of snow. Unfortunately, the band aren't a big fan of this record. They say it doesn't feel finished. This is where Liz Fraser's lyrics started to become a little bit strange. She often wasn't actually there for much of the recording. So Raymond and Guthrie would basically finish recording most of the instrumental, and then Liz Fraser would come in and start sort of improvising ideas and writing on the hoof. It's an odd process because it doesn't feel entirely... Well, it clearly isn't entirely integrated, but it seemed to work for them. But at this point, she was struggling with lyrics a wee bit, and she started doing things like her and Ivo Watts Russell, who was there, would go through the dictionary just to finish lyrics randomly with words, and so it ends up being a bit nonsensical. Slowly, that became a feature of what they did, and then soon she started, like as we mentioned earlier, deconstructing the words themselves. She would just say a simple word in a really odd way, emphasising certain syllables till it doesn't even sound like English, which, you know, is something that a lot of people really love about them. Tracks like Laura Lie, for example, which is, I think it's named after a Germanic siren. Tracks like that, yeah, she really goes to town and that kind of stuff.
And it's where Cocteau Twins start really sounding like kind of nobody else, or they, you know, pin down mm-hmm. their sound. But it is interesting that they hate that album, but it's seen along with Heaven or Las Vegas amongst fans as the favourite. And
yeah, when you look at the lists, acclaimed. It's always near the top. Yeah.
And yeah, it's weird because I'm kind of with them. It really annoys me.
Yeah, it sounds frustrating. The production's quite bad on it, I think.
Robin Guthrie refers to it as an abortion.
Yeah.
That's how much he hates it. He fucking hates it. They were really enamoured with Phil Spector, and especially see his work on things like The Ronettes, Be My Baby.
Yeah.
They really loved that approach, and I think they were trying to go for that, but it just fell a bit short. The guitar stuff, obviously, as we said, has a lot of effects. They'd begun using an Emu drum machine and a John Bonham sample pack. That became quite a big feature of not just their work, but also of a lot of the work of that era, especially that sample pack. The kind of bombastic nature of it became a big part of 80s sort of pop, especially where drum machines were involved. There were no singles on it either, which is again quite an anti-commercial move. You know, they've just turned down Top of the Pops, then you release an album and you don't put out any singles. It's for a band that were definitely on the cusp of making some pretty big strides. They were making some quite interesting decisions, and definitely not decisions I would hold against them. It's one of the things I like about them, actually. I mean, Pitchfork in retrospect has gushed endlessly over not just this band but this album. And I think the phrase that I picked out was, it's something of such otherworldly beauty. And like I was saying about the unimpeachables thing, I just don't really see it. You know, it's that thing where it just seems to be awarded by consensus. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Nobody,
I mean, Robert Smith says this is their most romantic sound.
Yeah, nobody wants to offend Robert Smith, so that's basically it.
Yeah, and then we just kind of get into their... They start, like, churning through their various records. So, yeah, I mean, Treasure, 84. They bring out a compilation of remixes and 7-inch versions, as I mentioned earlier on, in 1985, called The Pink Opaque, which is pretty interesting. It's pretty good. In 86, they bring out a record called Victoria Land, and Simon Raymonde is not involved in this album, so it's got very little percussion on it. And all I can say is it's got big Enya energy. And I think there is definitely an argument to say that Cocteau Twins are a hipster's Enya at times.
See, there's nothing wrong with that.
Not always, but honestly, sometimes people are kidding them fucking selves on when they listen to Cocteau Twins and refuse to acknowledge the parallels between Enya. And we've all heard the many jokes at Enya's expense, all right? But Cocteau Twins are pretty fucking close to that sometimes, and they get away with one just by virtue of their cool credentials and that Emperor.
Hey, Enya is just a rebranding away from being the hipster's Enya. Enya.
I still have the album you got me last Christmas.
Yeah, totally. I mean, ultimately, Victoria Land's kind of dull and like, I would say it's anemic.
It just doesn't feel like a proper Cocteau Twins album. Like, it, because Simon wasn't involved, and because it is basically just an ambient experimental thing, it, like, they should have just released it under another name. It kind of, but I kind of, but that's another thing that I appreciate. But appreciate about them is that they're happy to have this like in their discography, be experimental as hell, and release it as them. You know, they're not releasing, you know, pop singles, they're releasing weird ambient pieces of wank and, you know, and standing by them, even if it's not that it's, you know, there's interesting parts on it, of it, but I find it more interesting just the fact that they did it.
Yeah, I mean, it's consistent as well with that sort of like anti-commercial stance that they seem to have. They're quite unflustered by the notion of, oh, you could be missing out on a big breakthrough here. Like, they don't seem too bothered about that, and that is probably why they have the credibility that puts them in that sort of category alongside Waits and Bjork, you know, that very esoteric uttered approach that they take. I mean, the next thing they did was in 86 as well, and it was The Moon and the Melodies, which was like a collaboration with a guy called Harold Budd, who was like an avant-garde composer. Cocteau Twins aren't actually credited in this. It's kind of been added to the discography retrospectively because it was credited under the three individual names of Raymond, Guthrie and Fraser. It's an odd record. The second track in it, Memory Gongs, is kind of this kind of trippy sort of ambient score type thing. I struggled to listen to it. I think it only really succeeds by virtue of them being involved in it. I don't think it would be met with any great acclaim if it was just some randoms.
But it is another part of the Cocteau Twins curse with us, because Harold Budd died, I think it was the day after we recorded this the first time, didn't it? Didn't he?
So fucking hell, man. Our fault. I hope his family don't find out. Oh my God, yeah, we'll be... we'll be getting done for this.
I mean, I like this album because it doesn't have that many vocals on it, so that for me was something I enjoyed about it.
I was going to see just with that this ongoing curse factor in mind, are there any names we can throw in here in the off chance that maybe they drop dead in the next 24 hours? Have a think, we'll come back to that later in the episode. Talking about later in the episode, guys, I think we should break there, because we're at 86 and we're about to kind of embark in a few of their really strong albums. So yeah, how about we knock it in the head and come back to this?
Yeah, I can go turn the heating up in this room.
Yeah, you go do that, Dave. We will stay here, but you will listen to us again in a week.
Mark will be jamming on lit yet another week of glorious Cocteau Twins,
and we are much like the Cocteau Twins and stuck inside with snow outside.
Can I just fess up here? Actually, the first recording didn't fail. I just love subjecting Mark to Cocteau Twins.
This is just long term mental torture.
I saw his fucking door face, and I was like, "Fuck that!" Deleted it instead of saving it. I was like, "Oh, sorry, guys, the recording's failed." Oh well, Mark, another 4 weeks of winter.
God damn it, Chris.
We'll see you next week, folks.